Morning. Tricarici, guess I'm saying that right, probably not. This is PricewaterhouseCooper. Welcome this morning. I want you to note that Justice Bell is participating from Las Vegas. So I think we're ready to begin.
I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
May it please the court, Scott Hessel for the appellant Michael Tricarici. In early 2000, before Mr. Tricarici ever engaged PwC, PwC's national office took one look at a stock sale agreement with Fortran and immediately concluded that we are uncomfortable advising on taking any advisory role on this transaction, and then the WOW email immediately followed, where the local Portland official reacted to the advice from the national office by noting that the basic transaction was risky and that the clients could get sued for aiding and abetting tax evasion. 6 months later, members of the same national office at PwC of tax shelter specialists who worked down the hall from the WOW email recipients concluded Tricarici should do the stock sale transaction with Fortran 10 out of 10 times, that the transaction Mr. Tricarici was considering wasn't a listed Midco transaction and that he should not have any personal liability. If PwC had simply shared any part of the conclusions of the WOW email with Mr. Tricarici or his advisors, we would not be here and Mr. Tricarici would not have a judgment against him from the IRS of nearly twice what he got out of the transaction. Instead, PwC concealed the WOW email because it had a risk management policy that told its employees, if you discover circumstances calling into question our advice, you never admit it, which is precisely what 112075 prohibits. The only reason we're even here to tell this story is, frankly, serendipity, that Mr. Tricarici's case happened to survive long enough, and I happened to be counsel in the Marshall's case, where we pried the WOW email and concealment policy from PwC's hands on the eve of trial. At bottom, the court should not reward PwC's 20-plus years of concealment, but should allow Mr. Tricarici's 2003 claims and the disputed questions of fact, which should have resulted in denial of summary judgment, and allow those claims and the defense of statute of limitation to be presented at trial.
Counsel, if I may, why doesn't the IDR letter from the IRS in February of 2008 put your client on notice?
That is what the trial court below found in 2018. The letter itself, if you read it, and it's in page 7 of PwC's brief, what it actually says is that the IRS is examining Westside's tax returns, which was the company that Mr. Tricarici sold to Fortran. If the IRS determines that Westside's tax returns were incorrectly stated, and if Westside didn't pay the taxes associated with the transaction or had no assets to pay the transaction, we may determine that you have liability for Westside's taxes. That document by itself does not establish as a matter of uncontroverted fact that a reasonable person reading that document would know that the IRS is definitely coming after me.
But counsel, it doesn't require definite. I mean, doesn't it put the client on inquiry notice? Like, how might this affect me?
Well, the cases are fairly legion in this court and in other courts that the question of whether you knew or should have known is generally considered a question of fact. The reason why I said it had to be uncontroverted is because the only exception to that rule on summary judgment, which is where we were, is where the evidence is uncontroverted, that a reasonable person would then know that the IRS is coming after you. But the document on its face doesn't suggest that. And even accepting that it should have put him on notice, I think there are two other legal deficiencies with the trial court's ruling. One, he had not suffered any injury as of 2008. And two, the trial court's order did not address at all the concealment tolling provision of 112075.
112075 doesn't have the language that requires an injury, as other statutes of limitation do.
That's true. The question, what it does have, though, is a preamble that says that in order for a claim to be barred by 112075, you have to have an action for damages. That's the predicate to 112075 applying at all. So as of 2008, Mr. Tricarci has no claim for damages. He has no action for damages. He has suffered not $1 of injury as of that point in time. And as
how do you conceal bad advice?
Bad advice. The tolling provision seems to read that in the context of an accountant, we are going to put an affirmative obligation on them that if they later learn, or even if they, as is the case here, knew at the time that they had given the wrong advice, if they don't reveal that to the client, if they don't say, we have since determined that the basic transaction was risky and we shouldn't have told you that it wasn't, then for the entire period of time that they don't reveal it, they are not able to avail themselves of 112075's provision. And if I might, I did want to add one more response to the question about injury, which is Boulder City addressed language that is nearly identical to 112075 insofar as there was also the language that said that a person who has a claim against the city has to pursue within 6 months of the act complained of. And just like here, the act complained of, they didn't discover any injury. There was no problems with the foundation of the house for a year. And this court, in fairly compelling analysis, said, well, in a situation where somebody does not yet even have a cognizable claim, we are not going to find that that claim is time barred. We are going to wait until such time as the claim has ripened such that it is cognizable before we're going to require or we're going to impose a time bar. And it's identical language to here. It also didn't mention injury, like 112075 doesn't specifically mention injury. But there's also not just that case, but legions of cases since where this court has, in Peterson and in Adkins, where this court has concluded that until wrongful conduct ripens into an actual injury, there is no claim to yet pursue, which is also the point here, right? If this court were to conclude that 112075 requires Nevada Consumers of Accountants to sue within 4 years, regardless of whether the IRS or anyone else has challenged the transaction, then it would require flooding the courts with inchoate and not yet ripe claims, because the customer is then faced with the circumstance, I don't know whether the IRS is going to come after me. I don't know whether their advice may yet turn bad, and if I don't sue, the claims are toast. And on the flip side, all we're suggesting is that plaintiffs have to have injury before they sue. And the corollary of that is if you don't have a claim yet, then it certainly can't be time barred.
Counsel, I have a kind of more of a factual question. In terms of the inquiry notice in 2008, that wasn't necessarily a shot in the dark as I read this, because in 2003, as I understand it, there were discussions. Is this a Midco transaction? So it wasn't as if Tricarci wasn't aware that there was some concern about Midco transactions. Now, he was assured by Price Waterhouse this isn't one of those, and he proceeded. But when he got the notice in 2008, why isn't that reasonable for him to take action then?
Well, I think it actually goes, the factual circumstances here actually it goes the other way, which is nobody guaranteed him that the IRS might look at the transaction. Nobody guaranteed him that the transaction might be subject to scrutiny. What PwC's advice was is if it's ultimately litigated in tax court, you should not be subject to personal liability here because you've sold your stock. So the point I'm making here is that it is not often that the wrongful conduct doesn't result in simultaneous injury. The circumstances here are closely analogous to the litigation malpractice tolling rule, which is that where injury does not coincide with the wrongful conduct, and here the advice is essentially, here you have a risk, but that risk ultimately is going to be in your favor. And so until the IRS goes after Westside and Westside is not paid, and the IRS ultimately determines that Mr. Tricarci is on the hook, which doesn't happen until 2012. Between 2008 and 2012, in 2008, Westside had not even been assessed any liability. Westside hadn't even not paid yet, as they were obligated to do under the agreement with Mr. Tricarci. And Westside hadn't yet had no assets. If any of those ifs don't happen, Mr. Tricarci gets the full benefit of the bargain that he got from PwC, which was he was $7 million ahead as of 2008, meaning the taxes had been assumed by somebody else. If the IRS never comes after him, just like in the litigation tolling rule context, if the underlying case goes in his favor, or if the underlying case goes in favor or stays at the Westside level, there's no claim. Because he did know there was a possibility that the IRS would look at the transaction. And the only thing that happens in 2008 is he gets a document request asking for documents related to the transaction. That's it. It does say we may, if all these other ifs happen, come after you if Westside doesn't pay. But none of those ifs have yet transpired. He hasn't even incurred legal fees as of 2008. The only thing that's happened is that the IRS has identified, in fact, the language in the IRS notice is, we're examining Westside's tax returns. That's it. So from my point of view, because PwC claims that its advice was only on a more likely than not basis, everybody knew that it was possible that the IRS might look at it. The question is that Mr. Tricarci didn't know until after the trial in this case, is that PwC knew at the time it was advising him that it was a certainty that this was going to blow up at the IRS. It was a certainty that PwC should not be advising on this transaction and you may be subject to aiding and abetting liability, none of which was shared with him. They told him, 10 out of 10, do this deal. Because the...
Did you want to reserve any time? Chewing into your time.
Oh. 3 minutes is what I had reserved, so I'll stop there.
Good morning. May I begin?
Yes.
May it please the court. I'm Dan Taylor on behalf of the respondent, PwC. Your Honors, the district court correctly granted summary judgment on Mr. Tricarci's claims regarding PwC's 2003 advice because those claims were time-barred for three separate and independent reasons as laid out in the brief. First, they were time-barred under two different provisions of Nevada's statute of limitations for accountants. NRS 11-2075, 1A and B. And second, the claims were also time-barred under New York law, which applies to the claims by virtue of the choice of law clause in the contract. Turning first to Nevada law, because that's been so far the subject of discussion this morning. Mr. Tricarci's arguments regarding 11-2075 are simply inconsistent with the text of the statute. The legislature enacted very clear cutoffs in 11-2075 for malpractice claims against accountants. 11-2075 is very clear that such a claim must be brought within the earlier of 4 years after completion of the service, which is 1B, or 2 years after the act, error, or omission complained of is discovered or should have been discovered through diligence. That's the two-year discovery rule under 1A. And of course, as the court's questions have recognized, the district court granted summary judgment based on 1A because that really was the most generous limitations period for Mr. Tricarci. But I wanted to first start with 1B because under the plain text of 1B, Mr. Tricarci's claims were barred even earlier by October 2007. Because 1B says very clearly that the limitations period is 4 years after completion of performance, of the service for which the action is brought. Here there was no dispute, and in fact the district court made a finding that PwC's services in this case ended in October of 2003. That means under the plain text of 1B that the limitations clock ran out by October 2007. And I think it's notable that Mr. Tricarci didn't address 1B in his reply brief at all, even though we raised it as an alternative ground for affirmance in our responsive brief to this court. And it also wasn't raised this morning. And I think it's because simply there is no answer to those clear facts. Now, of course, Mr. Tricarci has made this general argument that well, damages or injury have to be required in order for the clock to start running. But that is simply incorrect as a matter of statutory interpretation and given the plain text of 11-2075. As the court recognized, the legislature knows how to write statutes of limitation which make injury or damages a requirement to start the clock ticking. It has done that in other statutes, and most interestingly in 11-207, which is a limitations period for attorneys and veterinarians. And we know that the legislature was very intentional in what it in how it treated accountants because, as we set forth in our notice of supplemental authority, given the legislative history, accountants until 1997 were included along with attorneys and veterinarians, you know, quite a motley crew, in 11-207. And 11-207 had a 4-year limitations period that started upon damages. But in 1997, the legislature enacted Assembly Bill 427 and pulled accountants out of 11-207 and created 11-207-5 as a standalone provision with separate rules for accountants. And as we also described, the legislative history, the committee minutes showed that the legislature understood exactly what it was doing. They understood the statute to be creating effectively a 4-year statute of repose, which is what a senator, the chairman of the committee, stated in the committee minutes. And again, that is the clear import of the plain language of 1B. Now, turning to, so we think the court could affirm under 1B without having to reach 1A at all. But turning to 1A, since the court, I did want to make sort of a general point about 1B, but it also applies to 1A. My friend Mr. Hessel made the point, or he referred to the, you know, the word damages in the introductory sentence of 11-2075 section 1. But that doesn't accomplish what he wants. The first sentence describes are the kinds of actions to which the limitations clocks apply. So they apply to a malpractice action to recover damages, as opposed to, say, an action for a different kind of relief, like injunctive or declaratory relief. But the word damages does not appear in the operative provisions of the statute, A, B, and C, which define the elements for starting the limitations clocks to tick. And this court would have to wholly rewrite the statute to move the word damages from the introductory sentence and put it into the very specific events that the legislature spelled out in A, B, and C for starting the clock to tick. So moving then to the ground that the district court adopted, section 1A, the district court was correct there. It was the most generous limitations period for Mr. Tricarci. Now, Mr. Tricarci and Mr. Hessel has made the argument that, well, damages, there were no damages. As we've just explained, that's wrong as a matter of statutory interpretation, but it's also an academic point as to 1A, because as we pointed out in our brief, Mr. Tricarci did have damages by early 2008 in the form of paying attorney's fees to respond to the IRS audit and inquiry. It's undisputed in the record that by late 2007, Mr. Tricarci had hired an attorney, Mr. Hart, to represent him at an interview with the IRS. That was in late 2007. The transcript of that is in the record at Respondent's Appendix 493. And then, of course, Mr. Hart is the attorney who collected the documents in response to the IDR from the IRS and produced them. And attorneys don't do that for free. Now, we know that attorney's fees are damages, or can be damages, because Mr. Tricarci claimed over $3 million of attorney's fees as damages in the 2022 bench trial. He claimed over $3 million of damages that he spent responding to the IRS and litigating with the IRS all before this case even initiated. And it's undisputed in the record that...
Counsel, do you think then he would have had a lawsuit if the IRS had ultimately found him not liable?
I don't know that he certainly could have filed the claim because he was put on inquiry notice and he had damages. Now, we certainly don't agree that he would have a meritorious claim in any event, but he certainly could have, he could have filed the claim. Alternatively, he could have asked PwC for a tolling agreement, which he actually did in 2011, and PwC agreed. And so...
If we read in a requirement of injury, wouldn't that date be February 3rd of 2009 when he got the letter from the IRS saying that he was liable?
I don't think so, Your Honor. February 3rd is when he got the draft transferee report, where the IRS put in more concrete terms that we are likely to, or these are the reasons we're holding you liable as a transferee. But what the district court relied on was the IDR, which came in January 2008. And the IDR said, we are auditing this transaction, and we are looking at you for transferee liability. And it said point blank, you may be held liable as a transferee for any unpaid tax liability. And again, as the court was discussing earlier, it's an inquiry notice standard, where you don't have to have a fully crystallized claim. The question is, do you have some facts that would lead you to investigate further as to whether you might have a claim? And the district court got it exactly right, that when your claim is that PwC gave the wrong advice in 2003 when it said that the transaction would be okay and wouldn't be challenged by the IRS, when you get hard evidence that that is not the case, that the IRS is auditing the transaction and the IRS clearly tells you you may be held liable as a transferee, that is inquiry notice at a minimum and as a matter of law.
If February 3rd of 2009 was the operative date, then the statute of limitations would be covered by the tolling agreements, right?
Yes, I believe that's correct, Justice Bell, because the I don't have it directly in front of me, but the effective date is sometime in January 2011.
Of January 19th, that sound right?
Yes, that doesn't sound incorrect. I apologize, I don't have the correct date in front of me, but I believe it was sometime in January 2011. If I could move on to the issue of tolling, because that's obviously where Mr. Hessel started his argument. And Mr. Hessel's tolling argument is all about this WOW email. And first, I think we need to remind ourselves that any argument about the WOW email must be viewed through the Rule 60B lens, because that is how it was raised. And of course, the district court's ruling on Rule 60B is subject to abuse of discretion. So there's a heavy thumb on the scale in favor of how the district court evaluated the WOW email and its conclusion that it would not have changed the district court's timeliness analysis. And the district court was clearly correct. The district court explained persuasively why this one email and this booklet wouldn't have made any difference to its timeliness ruling, because the district court's timeliness ruling was based on the fact that the IRS, through its IDR, put Mr. Tricarci on notice. And so this WOW email wouldn't have added or affected that analysis at all. And just to put a finer point on that, Mr. Hessel didn't discuss the elements of tolling under Section 2. And while this court has not explicitly interpreted the concealment tolling provision in 11-2075, it has interpreted essentially identical tolling provisions in other statutes, including the medical malpractice statute of limitation, which is NRS 41A.097. And this court has held in Libby and in Wynn that there are two elements required for concealment tolling. First, there has to be an intentional act of concealment. And second, that intentional act must objectively hinder a reasonably diligent patient, or excuse me, plaintiff, from timely filing suit. And Mr. Tricarci doesn't meet either element. Justice Bell, as you asked earlier, there is no intentional act of concealment. The only argument he's ever made was that PwC didn't come to him and tell him about its malpractice, or that it had given the wrong advice. But that is not enough under the law. The law is very clear that you have to have more than the underlying act of negligence itself, or the failure to disclose the underlying act of negligence, or the bad advice. Because if simply not telling someone about your alleged negligence were enough, then tolling would always apply, and the statute of limitations would be meaningless. So the district court correctly found that wasn't met here. But then on the second element, which Mr. Hessel didn't address, there's no evidence that any concealment impeded Mr. Tricarci from filing suit. We know that he filed this suit anyway in 2016 without the WOW email. And that's because the WOW email, as the district court correctly found, was a tiny piece of evidence about a completely different transaction that just would not have made a difference in the whole constellation of this case that spanned 9 years, for which there was a 10-day bench trial, and which involved the production of many, many thousands of documents. There was no abuse of discretion in determining that it wouldn't have made a difference. I did just, in my remaining minute, I did want to briefly touch on New York law, because it presents an alternative ground for affirmance in case the court does not want to wrestle with the interpretive questions of 11-2075. And as this court held in its mandamus decision, the terms of engagement attached to the engagement letter are binding on Mr. Tricarci. And those terms of engagement include a choice of law provision designating New York law. Now, there's no dispute that Mr. Tricarci's claims are untimely under New York law, because New York has a 3-year limitations period that runs from the date of service, and there's no potentially applicable tolling. So the only dispute is whether New York law should apply, and it should, because Nevada has a very strong public policy favoring freedom of contract, and in cases like Izguerdo and Mardian has made clear that it will enforce parties' contractual choices of law, including the limitations periods. I see my time has expired. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I want to just start with what we didn't hear there, which is there is no case in Nevada that holds that any of Chapter 11 statute of limitations, even with language that's similar to 11-2075, start running even where the plaintiff has not yet suffered injury. And there is a case, PwC cites not one, and there is a direct Supreme Court case, which I mentioned earlier, Boulder City, that says the opposite with nearly identical language.
Counsel had mentioned attorney's fees. Can you talk about that for a second?
I was shocked, actually, that he said that, because the only crumb that PwC cites to in all of their briefs that Mr. Tricarci incurred a single dollar of attorney's fees is an interrogatory response from Mr. Tricarci where they asked him, who has ever advised you with respect to disputes with the IRS? And among the 10 lawyers, he identified Mr. Hart as having advised him in 2008. That's it. He says the reasonable inference from that is, oh, well, you must have paid Mr. Hart. But the $3 million in attorney's fees that he mentioned, the whole record that was presented on the bench trial of all the attorney's fees that Mr. Tricarci incurred from beginning to end included no evidence of him having paid Mr. Hart, or Mr. Hart having billed him, or Mr. Hart having been engaged. It's pure speculation. In fact, what he said is attorneys don't do it for free. But we presented to the trial court all of the evidence we have of Mr. Takarchi's attorney's fees, and all of them begin after the 2009 notice, the draft notice in February of 2009. There is no evidence in this record that Mr. Takarchi incurred a single dollar of attorney's fees to anybody in 2008. All Mr. Hart did was write a letter responding to the IDR, and he did appear with Mr. Takarchi at the deposition. But there is no evidence that he billed for that time. There is no, we didn't claim it, and they didn't seek it, and they don't cite to any in the record. That's frankly why, and sort of returning to where we started here, 112075, even the 11th hour legislative history that they submitted on Friday, none of it indicates that the legislature intended to bar unaccrued claims. In fact, the concern that they have was accrued claims that don't get discovered for 20 years. The act or omission language in 112075 is intended to cabin the discovery rule, not the principle that you have to have a ripe or cognizable claim before this court is going to time bar. This would be the first case of any kind that's so held.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.